I am Plante on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. John Higgs joins me again. His latest book has just been published, and it's a thoroughly thoughtful, thought-provoking, and engaging book. The book is called Stranger Than We Can Imagine, an alternative history of the 20th century. In the book, Mr. Higgs discusses the great innovations of the century and contrasts it to the great discoveries of previous ones. And what he comes up with doesn't really make sense. The 20th century yielded for us relativity, psychedelics, postmodernism, cubism, and quantum entanglement, among many other things. Yet someone from the 19th century would be confused. He looks at the geniuses of the 20th century and their ideas and just how revolutionary they were to the century, and the comparison to previous ones. John Higgs was on last year for his book, Our Pet Queen, A New Perspective on Monarchy. His previous books include I Have America Surrounded, The Life of Timothy Leary, The Brandy of the Damned, and The KLF. He has directed more than 100 episodes of animated preschool television in Britain, and he created the long-running BBC radio quiz program, X Marks the Spot. The website for more is at johnhiggs.com. The book is published by Signal, which is an imprint of McClelland and Stewart. Please welcome back to the Plante Online program in Brighton, England today, John Higgs. Mr. Higgs, good morning.
Good morning. Nice to talk to you.
The same. I guess it's evening where you are, is that right?
Yes, it's evening, but I'll go by your time.
As I told you before we started, there's just so much in this book to discuss. It's such a full century, as I guess most centuries are. Mm-hmm. So let's begin at the fundamental difference as to the 20th century and, say, the previous one, the 1800s. Is there something that you can point to that say, would explain just how different those two centuries were, at least?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that was part of the reason for writing the book, was just a sense that at the beginning of the 20th century, something quite fundamental changed and things stopped making sense on an intuitive, common sense sort of level. Pretty much everything that mankind came up with before the end of the 19th century makes total sense to us. We sort of get it, whether you're talking about, I don't know, electricity or agriculture or steam engines or photography or language and all those things, they don't worry us. We might not fully understand the details, but we have a sense of what they're about. It's just when you hit the 20th century, and then, as you say in the introduction, you get Einstein and then you get cubism and modernism and quantum mechanics and existentialism and postmodernism and all these unsettling, disturbing, worrying sort of subjects. And the tendency I noticed in myself was to go, well, maybe I don't need to know about those things, maybe I can just sit those ones out and I'll catch up again when things start to make a bit more sense. And it's very tempting to do that, but it does mean that we're here in the 21st century looking at it with 19th century eyes and wondering why it doesn't make any sense. So yeah, I think the book was an attempt to understand what sort of happened, what was that fundamental change that occurred at the very beginning of the 20th century.
So we're 15 years into the 21st century. Do you look back at the 20th century with, say, 21st century eyes?
Yeah, I think, I mean, that sort of was the whole point of the book, is to make sense of now. Because there's a very sort of, the 20th century, the century we know the most about, there's a very clear narrative. I mean, we all know the story. We all know this First World War, Great Depression, Second World War, Hiroshima, Cold War, Berlin War. That's unarguable. That is the standard story. But for some reason, it just doesn't seem to lead to the modern world. It doesn't seem to be the story that explains how we got to where we are here. I mean, a lot of the stories in that book are not what you'd assume to be in a story about the 20th century, but they're there specifically to sort of create a different narrative, I guess, a different story that actually leads us into this digital network world that we all live in, and hopefully give it some context, and hopefully it will allow it to make a bit more sense.
So there is an arc to the narrative. I mean, there isn't history for you isn't just, say, events that happen randomly. That there is progress, I guess.
Definitely. Yeah, it's certainly not an encyclopedia by a long chalk. It's very much particular story in the when you've got all of the art and all of the science and all of the culture of the 20th century to choose from, you know, it's very clear you're going to have to be selective. It's very clear you're going to have to leave out a lot of, you know, valid and interesting subjects. And everything that's in there are there because they do direct us to where we are now. And they do tell a story that, that this, you know, because it's a, this network world we live in, this, you know, there's tsunamis of trivia and there's constant surveillance and there's, you know, incredible opportunity. It's a very sort of strange place. My story of the 20th century is the story of getting to where we are now, I guess.
Yeah, and so one of the things that I found interesting, because there are different topics that you cover, obviously, but they come together quite well, is this idea of how people themselves have changed. I mean, have our attitudes as people, have they changed? Do you find that we have, in those 100 years, become less, say, deferential to authority?
Very, very much so. I mean, I think that was what was the fundamental change that the 20th century was all about. I mean, it seems strange to us now, but at the beginning of the 20th century, you know, this was still a world that had emperors and czars and kaisers in it. It seems quite ludicrous. It seems like that should be, you know, much further into history. But pretty much all of the globe, you know, there's the Russian Empire, German Empire, British Empire, Austro-Hungarian Empire, Japanese Empire, Chinese Empire, was either, you know, a hierarchical imperial structure, or it was colonized by a similar sort of thing. And that was normal. That was the way mankind had organized itself forever, you know, from Alexander the Great, from before then. It was sort of the only known model for how mankind organized itself was the empire, with an emperor, with a sitting at the top, with some form of sort of absolute right to be there. And come the end of the First World War, that was all gone. It was like in the blink of an eye, the way mankind had organized itself always was rejected, because it was simply not tenable in a world of industrial warfare that you could have all that power within the state. And so we understood ourselves by our place in the hierarchy. It's that whole thing, you must know your place. It didn't really matter, you know, if you were smart or kind or good or intelligent or original or whatever. It mattered whether you were a serf or a general or what your position was. That, you know, that was how we understood ourselves, that sense of knowing our place. That was just blown away by the 20th century. And we all of a sudden, we were sort of these free-floating, self-willed individuals trying to come to terms with understanding the world from the point of view as an individual, with all the contradictions that involve, and, you know, like the democracy and this huge sense of the rise of individualism that the 20th century was about. So that was a real, real serious shift in how we understood ourselves. And weirdly, it just ran through everything. It was in science, particularly relativity, but you find it in art, and as well as the politics I was talking about, or geopolitical sort of structures. It was just a total shift. It was a very strange thing.
Yeah, we would used to think of the world, say the center of the world was whatever empire was ruling at the moment. And so have you noticed then, coming into the 21st century, that the center has shifted and the center really is us? Because we generally, I mean, most people will say that people nowadays have become more egotistical. Is that a correct assumption?
That's definitely a fair comment based on the 20th century. Yeah, definitely. It was, as I say, at the beginning, this notion of the omphalos. You know, an omphalos is the center of the world. It's like the world's navel, the world tree. Every ancient culture has its own omphalos, whether it's Delphi in Greece or for the Aboriginal Japanese, it was Mount Fuji. It was the Black Hills for the Sioux Indians. It was Rome for the Romans. It was Jerusalem for the Middle Ages. And at the end of the 19th century, it was Greenwich. It was the zero meridian. That was where everywhere on the world was made. But it wasn't a case that it was, when we say something, one place is the centre of the world, that's just something we're projecting on ourselves. It is not at all. The world itself doesn't have a particular quality. For the French would say actually the centre of the world is 0 point, which is just in front of Notre Dame Cathedral, and that's where they sort of measured everything from, rather than the prime meridian over Greenwich.
Yeah.
And that notion that the centre of the world is essentially arbitrary. It's just what we've decided to say it is, and it doesn't really have any quality to it other than that. Again, is another way of reiterating that huge shift at the start of the 20th century. You see it especially in Einstein's work, rejection of a particular frame of reference from which everything can be understood and which everything makes sense. That's gone. That was just swept away by the 20th century.
When you look at social media, the rise of that, and say selfies and sort of the egotistical nature of all of that, you can explain that best by looking at the 20th century, can't you?
Yes, you can. But at the end of the 20th century, there was this other huge shift in how we came to understand ourselves. When the network sort of appeared, people started to see themselves not just as the individual that the 20th century was all about, but as part of a wider group. In the 20th century, we had heroes like the Clint Eastwood character, the man with no name.
Mm-hmm.
He was sort of the pinnacle of, the free individual. And I mean, he was so, and an individual is by definition isolated. And he was so isolated, didn't even have a name. That's how isolated that character was. And in the 20th century, we loved that. We thought, oh, that was terrific. But now, at the end of the 20th century, and I'd say during the whole of the second half of the 20th century, there's this weird shift away from ourselves as an individual and understanding ourselves as part of, complex systems. Chaos math feeds into this, the environmental movement feeds into this, but particularly the internet certainly feeds into this. We can't explain ourselves without explaining what we're connected to. That's part of us. I think a nice way of sort of thinking of that shift is as you say, selfies. You see somebody taking a photo of themselves. And if like me, you're born and raised in the 20th century, the tendency is to think of that as, in egotistical terms, as narcissism or vanity.
Yeah.
A person taking one photo of themselves to look at themselves. But, to my kids, to the millennial generation, they don't see it like that at all. They see someone smiling at their friends. They see someone strengthening their social bonds. They wouldn't describe a selfie as one person taking a picture of themselves, because that doesn't explain what it is. Much more is going on, that they're aware of. They immediately view themselves as part of a network, in the way that we from the 20th century tended to view ourselves as this isolated, free individual. It's been a real big shift. And this whole rise of the individual in the 20th century, rather being the next major step, in our culture, seems to have been a liminal period, a period in between when we understood ourselves as part of a hierarchy. And now, as we understand ourselves as part of a network, Quite big changes going on here.
Yeah, you illustrate this marvelously, and when you talk about the song "My Way," the Frank Sinatra song. What that represents, because we've all heard that song. Even Sinatra hated that song because it's kind of, if you look at it, it's kind of hokey. It's really egotistical. And people have used it at funerals and memorial services and the sort. And the way you talk about that, John, and how it's nostalgic now.
Yeah, I think this book does anything, I think it should ruin that song for anyone who reads it. I remember used to think that if you can get to the end of your life and play "My Way" and smile, then you've done, you've had a good life, you've done it your way, you've, You know, you've sort of, you know, your life was good. But when you look at that song, my friend, you know, it's all I, mm-hmm. me. I, you know, I'll tell you straight. You know, it's a person. It's a song of a person trying to force their perspective onto other people. It's not the song of a person who's an integrated part of a larger group. And in the 20th century, that sounded great. You know, that sounded really admirable. But now, I think, when you listen to it, it just feels a little tragic. Just this isolated person just sort of trying to force the world to be how they want it to be, rather than being part of it, rather than being an integrated part of a larger world, and having a value on that terms. It's strange how just a few decades can change the meaning of a song like that.
And a lot of people have described the 20th century as the American century. I'm a Canadian, John. You know, you're Welsh. When you look at the 20th century and you try to write a history of it as you have in this book, the influence of America, I mean, that's unmistakable. That's undeniable. So,
absolutely.
How do you come to terms with it then?
Well, I mean, the if you look for where the center of change, this usually there's one point in the world that's where it's all happening, where everybody sort of come together. In the first half of the 20th century, it was Germany, or the German-speaking European country. I'm including Austria, I'm including parts of Switzerland in that place, like Vienna. But the German-speaking Europe was where the great cultural changes from Freud to Einstein was all coming from, and that was you know, nowhere on earth could compete with that. Okay, France, artistically maybe, but really it was really happening in Germany. And then of course, middle of the century, that Germany was struck down by the cancer of fascism, and it could have gone either way at that point. It could have gone to the communist Russia, or it could have gone to North America, particularly mm-hmm. the United States. Which was the Great Cold War, and that's where this became symbolized, this space race, you know. And you know, the fact is, the United States went to the moon, which to my mind is quite simply the most incredible thing that mankind has ever done. You know, they actually went to the moon with 1960s technology, just extraordinary. So yeah, I've got no question that they won the right to say it's the American century, or certainly the American half century.
One of the views though of America is that it's just unlimited growth. That the arc, there's no arc really. It just goes up and up. And that applies to, say, growth in terms of the economy, capitalism itself, the environment in terms of sustainability. So if that's what America sort of embodies, is where is the 20th century headed? And it can't be infinite.
No, I mean, that it's very much a 20th century viewpoint, a very much a 20th century idea. America was about the frontier. You know, it was about a land of seemingly vast, endless resources to be used, to be made something of. But as I say, they went to the moon. And what's remarkable about that is not the moon itself. It's when Apollo 8 sort of came round the dark side and saw for the first time the whole Earth just hanging in this vast, vast black void, which no human eye had ever seen, and it made such an impact, certainly on the astronauts there, but certainly on the rest of us, and just from the photographs of it made an impact. You know, all the things like the environmental movement are linked to these very, very first images of the Earth from space, because it's the realization that it wasn't infinite, that it wasn't a vast frontier going onwards. It was just this tiny, tiny thin wisp of atmosphere. damp, wet rock, which was the only place that mankind could live and survive. And it, and there was no sense of, you know, any help coming from elsewhere for it. And it just was revealed as fragile and limited. And again, this is this shift away into, away from individualism, this way of understanding ourselves in the latter half of the 20th century, the sort of feeding into the network. And it's all tied up with chaos maps and complex systems and, you know, how we understand things like ecosystems and things like that. The notion of infinite growth, of constant going upwards, made perfect sense in the middle of the 20th century. Now it's ludicrous, you know. Obviously, some people still cling to it, intuitively, but, you know, it's impossible to defend. It's just crazy.
So where do you think we're headed for a crash, then?
Well, I'm sort of, you know, it's a tricky question. I mean, it'd be interesting to see what happens in Paris. It doesn't look good. I mean, in the book towards the end, I made reference to this. If we take stock of what we know about our situation now, and we project out into the future, the 21st century does appear to be the penultimate century for Western civilization, to a point where, you know, we can still feed the 7 billion people and things like that, based on what we know about climate science and projecting all that forward. And I'm an optimist, you know, and in many ways I've been a bit optimistic there. But because the millennial generation understand themselves in a different way than, you know, we from the 20th century do, because the idea of infinite growth forever is ridiculous to them, because they understand complex systems and networks and all these sort of things, I still feel optimistic that it's not going to be as bleak as it immediately looks. Now, if you were to imagine that the, you know, Western people from the mid to late 20th century were not going to change, and that was what mankind would be like for the next couple of hundred years, then we'd be doomed. You know, we would have no hope. But people have changed.
Yeah.
The next generation do understand their situation in a way that we didn't, we from the 20th century. So, I don't know, it's a lot on their shoulders, but I feel there's something about them. I can still be optimistic about it, I think.
The other thing that the book does wonderfully is explain postmodernism, and the way, one of the ways that you do it in this book is saying that Super Mario Brothers, that video game, really explains what postmodernism is, and just our acceptance of it. I mean, I used to play it as a kid, and you know, I never really thought about what it all meant, because now that you think about it, it's just a very odd game. Everything about it.
It's totally nuts. None of it makes any sense at all, except on its own terms. You know, it's got an Italian plumber. Okay, that's fine.
Yeah.
It's an Italian plumber in a fantasy world trying to rescue a princess from a giant turtle, whilst flowers spit fire at him and giant bullets are going everywhere. It's just a combination of all these ingredients that don't fit together, that don't make any sense at all. But it doesn't. It's fine for Super Mario Brothers, because it's a product of a sort of a postmodern age where the thing only has to make sense on its own terms. It doesn't sort of need the validation of an external sort of framework to justify itself. And that's a key part of what postmodernism is. And the book also lists about three or four other ways in which Super Mario Brothers sort of explains what postmodernism is. But it was a way of where we are now. Postmodernism is an insult, right? You can use it to I dismiss something.
Yeah.
Postmodernism, it's a rejected sort of form of thought. And it's a lot to do with the relationship between postmodernism and academia, you know, which didn't go well, which ended very, very badly. Because postmodernism, as I say, doesn't need the validation of an external sort of framework to justify itself. But that's sort of what academia is, a sort of a framework of knowledge that explains everything else. So they're incompatible. It was sort of never going to work. And so postmodernism has become this sort of damned word, this sort of doom, sort of... it's like a wrong turning, we all talk. We took this embarrassing wrong turning, and we'll say sorry about it, we won't talk about it ever again. But that doesn't really... If you ignore it like that, you sort of... You can't really explain a lot of the late 20th century, because everything was so postmodernism. And when things like Super Mario Brothers, you know, which is for kids, which is 5-year-olds understood, you know, was postmodernism. And when at the other end of the scale, the art world would be selling Liechtenstein for $42 million, which are
right.
You know, little frames from a comic which have been ripped off and drawn up big, which is a very postmodern sort of thing. When the rest of culture is absorbing postmodern ideals and using them without, you know, without shame, without needing to explain them, the fact that academia has had such a bad time with it, you know, is a little bit unnecessary. You sort of have to sort of, you can't dismiss postmodernism totally just because
yeah.
it's because of academic postmodern discourse being so dense and impenetrable and meaningless, I guess.
Yeah, and it's just taken on its own meaning. That's how we view it and the world through those lenses.
Yes.
John, there's so much in this book, as I said, to talk about that I found it very difficult to limit myself in terms of what we talked about. Otherwise, we'd be here for several hours. But I do suggest people pick up this book because it's as I said in the introduction, just a terribly engaging read. Congratulations on this book. Continued good luck with it. Thanks for this, John. It's nice talking again. Good night.
Thanks very much. Good night.
The website for more, johnhiggs.com. The book is called Stranger Than We Can Imagine, an alternative history of the 20th century. It's published by Signal, which is an imprint of McClelland and Stewart. Its author, John Higgs, joined me on the line from Brighton in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunton.